This talk is one of hundreds of hours of leading Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to get our monthly email. More resources to support ministry are available to you now. The European Leadership Forum exists to connect local Christian leaders with God's global resources.
All right, how's that? Okay. Yeah, we have nothing against the traditional reasons. It's just that my experience as an evangelism pastor is that trying to talk to strangers about the historical evidence for the bodily resurrection doesn't get you very far. But people are always willing to talk about some scientific discovery from the past 3 or 4 days. And so we use these new reasons as a bridge for the traditional reasons. And this afternoon, I want to talk about human origins. And throughout this week, we'll be addressing different portions of the science disciplines and how they're providing new evidences for the Christian faith. So later on, I'll be talking about the origin of life, and we'll be talking about some discoveries about dark energy and cosmic darkness. And I gave a talk this morning about the new astronomical evidences for God. Also, I'll be participating in the dialogue on how do we interpret Genesis 1 through 3. And that's something we're active in, not just doing research on the scientific issues, but doing research on the biblical issues. Basically trying to help Christians integrate the 20 big creation accounts in the Bible. I don't know what it's like here in Europe, but in the States we have this perception that all the answers are in Genesis, when in fact most of the creation answers are outside the book of Genesis. So trying to encourage people to integrate the whole scope of Scripture. And what you discover, for example, is that Job 38 and 39, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8 in particular have much more scientific content in it than anything you find in the book of Genesis. So that's what we're all about. And this subject of human origins is probably the most controversial of all the creation evolution issues. It's something everybody gets emotional about. And I've got a slide here to kind of demonstrate some of the emotional. I mean, you know the story. You start with the primitive bipedal primate species you see on the left, and they claim that it gradually evolves into the advanced creature on the right. And incidentally, I've got a whole bunch of these slides for different cultures. When I'm speaking in Japan, I put a sumo wrestler over there. When I'm in Canada, it's a hockey player. I mean, you can kind of work out your own sports bias to make the point. And the reason I'm not going to do this today, but typically when I speak on human origins, I throw a lot of humor in because people get really uptight on the subject of human origins. You can just see the tension rise in the audience. And especially when you've got a mixed audience of Christians and non-Christians, the tension can get very high. But the good news about human origins is that we have learned more in the past 3 or 4 years than we've learned since the beginning of time. Whereas 3 or 4 years ago, I would tell you that you could take the sum total of all the fossil bones for the hominids that have been discovered and fit it quite nicely into a closet. Well, today you need kind of the equivalent of a hotel room to do it. It's still not a lot of data, but it's a lot more than we've had before. And I think what's particularly exciting is for the first time, we're recovering meaningful DNA evidence, not just from human beings, but from the other bipedal primate species. And so we're able to say a lot more about human origins from a scientific perspective than we ever could before. For example, 4 years ago, I would say there's no way we can compare the biblical date for human origins with a scientific date. Now we can make quite a definitive comparison. So that's what I'm going to talk to you all about. And in terms of the fossil record, it's in the textbooks that there's this beautiful tree where you start off with this bipedal primate specimen that branches off into more complex bipedal primates. Well, now the consensus is we're not looking at a fossil tree for human origins, we're looking at a fossil bush. And, you know, 5 million years ago, you see a whole litany of bipedal primates, and they cover the whole realm of bipedal capability. And as you move up towards the present era, it remains bushy all the way through. And so this is a complete unexpected result from an evolutionary perspective. From an evolutionary perspective, you would demand a tree. It must be a tree in order for this to have a natural explanation. The fact that it looks like a bush where you have several stumps at the base and no more stumps at the top. And the fact that every time they find a new bipedal primate species, and they typically find a new one every year, but every new one throws the whole evolutionary discipline to chaos because every new discovery fails to fit the evolutionary paradigm. Now, that by itself, I think, is a really significant apologetic insight, that the new discoveries are throwing the discipline into chaos rather than pulling it into order and developing some explanatory power. But one of the questions we need to address from a Christian perspective, if indeed there's this forest of bipedal primates, why would the God of the Bible create all these bipedal primate species? Why not just create human beings and be done with it? Why do we see this litany of bipedal primates that literally starts 6.5 million years ago and goes up to the present day? What divine purposes are behind that? Well, in terms of trying to come up with some evolutionary order for the time sequence of the bipedal primate species, there isn't any. But there is one from a Christian perspective. In this sense, that what we observe is that every successive bipedal primate species is a little more capable than the previous one to hunt birds and mammals. So the earliest ones are not very effective at all. In fact, there's some doubt whether they even had much of their diet come from birds and mammals. But by the time you get to Homo sapiens ideltu and Neanderthals, they're quite effective at killing birds and mammals. In fact, with particularly Neanderthals, it looks like 100% of their diet came from large bird and mammal, large body-sized bird and mammal species. Now, from a Christian perspective, this makes sense, in that when God created Adam and Eve, our planet had 22,000 bird species. Today, it has only 9,000. How did those 13,000 disappear? Basically, we human beings ate them all. We drove them to extinction. And likewise, we did the same thing with the land mammals. When Adam and Eve first showed up on the scene, there were 8,000 land mammal species on the planet. Today, there's only 4,000. North America, for example, before humans invaded about 12,000 years ago, was filled with camels, lions, tigers, horses, all kinds of elephants. But when the humans came over the Bering Land Bridge, within about 1,000 years, they drove all the large land mammal species to extinction. And now, from a Christian perspective, we understand how this happened. If you look in Genesis chapter 1, God commands Adam and Eve to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. Adam and Eve were put in charge of the planet. That's one reason why God told them, you are to multiply, to be fruitful, and to multiply and occupy the whole planet. I mean, how can you take care of the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life if you don't multiply to a degree where you can actually occupy the entire planet? In that sense, I think there's a biblical mandate for biologists to catalog all the species of life on planet Earth. And even at this point, we've probably only cataloged 25%. So in that sense, we're just beginning to fulfill a portion of that mandate in Genesis 1, 29 through to 31. But what you see in the last verse of Genesis 1 is that we have God commanding Adam and Eve to take special care of the green plants. Green plants are the base of the food chain. And this is why, you know, a lot of people look at that passage and say this implies that all life was vegetarian. No, if that was the case, it would simply mention plants. But the focus on green plants is an instruction to Adam and Eve that if you're going to manage the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life, number one priority, take care of the green plants. Because if you don't take care of those, then nobody gets to eat. But then we know what happened. Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve fall into sin. And when they fall into sin, they begin to abuse their environment. You know, and I'll be speaking tomorrow in the response to Williams and Blochet that what happened at the fall was not changes in the laws of physics or change in the universe. It was a change in humanity. The environment became ruined because of us, as the text says. And a part of that ruination is we began to particularly abuse those creatures that God had specially designed to have a powerful affinity with us. This really comes out in Job 39, that one of the things God did with the soulish creatures, the birds and mammals, is He endowed them with a strong desire to have affinity with us. And when we fell into sin, we took advantage of that affinity and began to slaughter them off. Now, God, knowing in advance that Adam and Eve would sin, and knowing in advance the consequences of that sin, do you not think He would prepare the birds and mammals in advance by creating a sequence of bipedal primates over the course of several million years, so that step by step these birds and mammals could adapt to the coming future shock of human beings? And this is exactly how I think we can reasonably interpret the sequence of these bipedal primates. Each one was a little more effective than the previous in hunting birds and mammals, and hence these birds and mammals would become progressively better adapted to deal with the predatory activity of the future coming sinful human species. Now, did I draw that from the Bible? Not at all. What the Bible is fairly silent on this issue, and by the way, we'd expect the Bible to be silent on this issue. Notice in terms of the creation content of the Bible, everything has a point of contact with every generation. This is why I believe that the Bible correctly doesn't mention neutrinos. Neutrinos would have no point of contact with people living 3,000 years ago. Likewise, to mention bipedal primates would have no point of contact with any generation but our own. That's why I also take the position that dinosaurs are not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. Some Christians read dinosaurs into Job 40 and 41, but the plain explanation is dinosaurs would have a point of contact only with people living over the last 200 years. And so given that, we would not expect the Bible to address this issue of bipedal primates or to explain why they were created. And so this is something that we're simply reasonably imposing upon the data and saying this is a good explanation for why these creatures do show up when they do in the order that they do. But my argument is, from an evolutionary perspective, they have no explanation at all. Now, in terms of who is Homo sapiens? Something that's very confusing for lay people in the subject of anthropology is the distinction between human beings and Homo sapiens. If you were educated 30 years ago, you were taught that we humans are Homo sapiens. That's not what the scientific literature is saying today. The scientific literature makes a distinction between Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens would include Neanderthals. It would include Homo sapiens idaltu. And by the way, Homo sapiens idaltu lived at about the same time as the Neanderthals. And they're essentially a tropical version of the Neanderthals. The Neanderthals' morphology was very well designed for a cold climate. Homo sapiens idaltu, who had the same intellectual capabilities as Neanderthal, was well adapted for the tropics. But in terms of fossil finds, we don't have that many fossil finds for Homo sapiens idaltu. And there's great dispute over the finds in Israel that date back 90,000 to 100,000 years ago. We simply don't have adequate finds there. And we don't have DNA from either Homo sapiens idaltu or the primitive Homo sapiens that are being found in the neighborhood of Carmel, Israel. But they're not human. And they lived about 70 to 160,000 years ago. Now, in terms of who are these Neanderthals, in the case of the Neanderthals, we do have mitochondrial DNA. Now, the value of mitochondrial DNA is that all of us get our mitochondrial DNA exclusively from our mothers, which makes us an excellent tool for testing theories of creation evolution. In this sense, the only way my mitochondrial DNA can be distinct from my mother's is if I experience a natural mutation in my mitochondrial DNA. Since my father makes no contribution, there's no mixing up of the DNA in reproduction. And therefore, this is an excellent tool for tracing the female lineage of any species. Now, this is a little out of date. I prepared this overhead 2 weeks ago, And in the last 2 weeks, they have found an 11th specimen from which they had recovered mitochondrial DNA. So as of a couple of weeks ago, we now have 11 specimens of Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. And interestingly, these 11 specimens cover the entire range of the Neanderthals. They range from, say, Spain, France, and Britain, all the way across Europe, towards the Urals, and down into the Caucasus region. And these 11 specimens cover the entire range. They also cover the entire range over the dates for Neanderthal. Neanderthal dates from about 150,000 years ago to about 35 to 38,000 years ago. And as we look at these 11 mitochondrial DNA specimens, what we notice is virtually no diversity. What that tells us is that over those 120,000 years, Neanderthal did not evolve. Now, if Neanderthal is not evolving, how can Neanderthal give rise to another species? And now, where did Neanderthal get its DNA unless it was specially created? Because a previously existing species wouldn't be expected to evolve any more rapidly. But the other thing we notice is that we can compare the mitochondrial DNA from Neanderthals with the mitochondrial DNA for humans. Now, in a significant strip of that mitochondrial DNA, they can find 25 nucleotide sites where the Neanderthals vary with respect to one another. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, thousands of nucleotides, and there's only 25 where Neanderthals show any variation. And we don't see any trend over those 120,000 years. Now, if you look at humans, and with respect to humans, they have samples that go back 40,000 years. And over the last 40,000 years, and we look at people today all over the world, we can find in that same mitochondrial DNA segment only 8 sites where humans show any diversity. There's only 8 nucleotide sites that vary. Now, that demonstrates that over the past 40,000 years, humans have not evolved. So mitochondrial DNA is definitively established that neither Neanderthal has evolved and humans have not evolved. But what's really interesting is these 8 sites where humans show some diversity, none of those 8 overlap any of the 25 where Neanderthal shows diversity. And that definitively proves that Neanderthal made zero contribution to the human gene pool. So the old textbook story that we evolved from the Neanderthals has now once and for all been put to rest. And this is a consensus amongst the leading geneticists working in the discipline, that Neanderthal can't possibly be the ancestor of humanity or contributed even a tiny amount to human DNA. So, in summary, this mitochondrial DNA proves that humans did not evolve. It also proves that Neanderthals did not evolve. Now, with humans, we don't have any Y chromosome DNA from Neanderthals, but we do have Y chromosome DNA for humans. By the way, there's a reason why we don't get it from the Neanderthals. With the Y chromosome DNA, that's nuclear DNA, and you only get 2 copies per cell. With a mitochondrial DNA, you get 500 to 1,000 copies per cell. So it's a lot easier to reconstruct ancient mitochondrial DNA than it is to construct ancient Y chromosome DNA. And you say, can we go to the other bipedal primates? Most geneticists believe that there's virtually a zero chance that we'll ever recover intact DNA from any other bipedal primate species, simply because they're too ancient. We may be able to get it from Homo sapiens idelta, and maybe the archaic Homo sapiens we see in Israel. Those are only about 100,000 years old. But as far as Homo erectus goes, that's 1.8 million to about 500,000 years ago. That's too much time. And that amount of time, the DNA will degrade to a point where you simply can't reconstruct it. But mitochondrial DNA, you can dig significantly deeper into the past than you can with Y chromosome. So that's the reason why we only have Y chromosome for humans. But when you look at our Y chromosome DNA, just like with the mitochondrial DNA, it demonstrates that there is no evolution going on in human Y chromosome. Humans that have been dead 30 to 40,000 years reveal a Y chromosome that's indistinguishable from the Y chromosomes of modern humans. And in the case of Y chromosome diversity, it's even less than what we see for the mitochondrial DNA. So that establishes by two independent lines that the human species has not evolved. Now, I mentioned here the great apes because they've been able to recover Y chromosomes from living gorillas, two different species, both the mountain gorillas and the valley gorillas, and orangutans and chimpanzees. And what they notice in those four species is that just like with humans, you see very little diversity. And yet we compare the Y chromosome of, say, mountain gorillas with orangutans or with chimpanzees or with humans, you see a huge difference. Now, the old story was that these great apes and humans had a common ancestor anywhere from 5 to 20 million years ago. But that no longer washes, because we can see that there's very little diversity in each of these species, and yet there's a huge difference when you go from species to species, which means that 20 million years would not be adequate time to explain the differences in the Y chromosomes in between the species, among the species, given that there's so little diversity in each species. That low amount of diversity tells us that the rate of evolution is slow. By the way, this is something that fits perfectly our reasons to believe speciation model. We have this published in this book, The Genesis Question, where we talk about how about a dozen years ago now, we assembled a team of leading evolutionary biologists who are all Christians from Caltech, UCLA, UC Irvine, University of Southern California, UC Riverside, UC San Diego, literally California's best universities. And we had them come to our office every couple of months over the span of about 2.5 years. And our goal was to build a mathematical model to predict speciation from a naturalistic perspective. And the driving mechanisms of evolutionary change are natural selection and mutations. Well, we quickly figured out that natural selection isn't going to do a lot for you. Mutations are really the only way you're going to generate big changes. But the problem is that when you look at the genomes of different life forms, you notice that you get at least 10,000 deleterious mutations. These are mutations that are harmful for the survival of the species for every beneficial mutation. And sometimes the ratio gets as bad as 10 million to 1, but the best you see is 10,000 to 1. And then the reason why we had some physicists and mathematicians, and along with the evolutionary biologists, is to make the point that no one in biology has built a speciation model taking into account that the solar system significantly changes over time and the planet significantly changes. As I was talking this morning, our planet is now rotating 6 times more slowly than when God first created bacteria on the planet. The radioactive output from the core of the Earth is only 1/5 of what it was. And we have the sun 15% brighter today. And the problem or the challenge for every life form is to be able to pick up on the benefit of the beneficial mutations before that species is driven to extinction by either the deleterious mutations or by the changes in the physics of the Earth and the Sun. And the bottom line is this: a species is guaranteed to go extinct before it can evolve into a different species unless its population exceeds 1 quadrillion, unless its body size is less than 1 centimeter, and unless its generation time is briefer than 3 months. That's the time between being born and being able to give birth. Well, if you look at the primates, none of them are anywhere close to those limits. None of the primates number more than a few billion in the population, and all of us have huge body sizes, much bigger than 1 centimeter across, and we all take significantly longer than 3 months to reproduce. And so this really beautifully explains why we're seeing no genetic evidence for evolution in orangutans, chimpanzees, gorillas, human beings, and Neanderthals. For what it's worth, we believe that our mathematical model is much too conservative. because our model, if our numbers were right, would predict that we would witness the appearance of a brand new bacterial species about once every year. And we've had the capacity to pick up these additional bacterial species at least for the past 150 years. And over that 150 years, we have seen zero bacterial species come into existence. So that tells us that we were too conservative in our numbers, which is not surprising because we didn't have very good data to work with. We were just doing the best we could. But let me move on. One of the things that the Bible definitively says, all right, here we go. Got to find my cursor. You see it. There it is. Okay. What does the Bible definitively say about human origins? I mean, it says a lot, but much of it is difficult to pin down specifically. But one of the things we can be certain about is it tells us that Adam and Eve were the last of God's creation miracles. When God created Eve, he went into a state of rest and still remains in that state of rest according to Hebrews 4. This is that day of creation when God does not create new species of life. And this is something that's well witnessed by the biological community. We see all kinds of extinctions, but we have yet to witness the appearance of even one animal species in the record of nature. But the fossil record tells us that there was abundant speciation going on at an average of one new species appearing every year before the human race shows up on the scene. The other thing the Bible definitively tells us is that humans were the only spirit species that God created on earth. One of the points, this book is coming out in September, Who is Adam?, our latest book on our 10-book series on our testable creation model. And one of the things we point out is that if you want to destroy the Christian faith, then just prove that the human species has no unique attributes. I would argue that Christianity is fundamentally built on the biblical doctrine that we humans are special in all the species of life that God created. We have three different kinds of animals, according to Genesis 1 and Psalm 104, that God creates. They're the purely physical creatures, like the bacteria, the viruses, and the insects. And then we have the soulish creatures, like the birds and mammals, and a couple of species of the higher reptiles, and then we have human beings. The soulish animals, Old Testament definition, are those creatures endowed by God with mind, will, and emotions to form relationships with human beings. But we alone are body, soul, and spirit, and it's our spirit component that enables us to discover God and form a relationship with God. So I particularly enjoy Job 39 in the sense that it tells us how God designed these creatures to have this powerful desire to relate to us. Well, likewise, we are created to have a powerful desire to relate to God. Sin gets in the way, of course, but nevertheless, there is that spirit component to us. So we are the only species, according to the Bible, that wonders about what's coming after we finish this life. The soulish creatures, according to Ecclesiastes, when they die, they go to the dust. Incidentally, that's one of the points we get criticized a lot for in the Christian community, this idea that dogs won't go to heaven. And incidentally, we're not saying there aren't dogs in heaven, just that it's not going to be the dogs we had here on earth. They go to the dust. Only the spirit creatures are eternal. When God creates them, they last forever. That's why I also believe that there won't be annihilation, that even the condemned will continue to live for all eternity. That which is spiritual is eternal. But if you wanted to disprove the Christian faith, just prove that there is no such thing as a separate attribute of the human species or relative to other species. That's exactly what the atheists are trying to do. They're trying to demonstrate that we differ with respect to the other animals only by degree, not by unique attribute. So this is a critical point where we can put different creation models to the test. But one of the things we've done at Reasons to Believe, and this will be published in this book, Who is Adam?, is to try to look at the Genesis genealogies and calibrate them. You know, and I've talked this over with a number of Hebrew scholars and systematic theologians, and what I notice is there's a consensus amongst these theologians that there are gaps in the genealogies. Even the young earth creationist theologians concede that there must be gaps in the genealogies. The big debate is how many. Young earth creationists argue there's only a few gaps. Some old earth creationists argue for a lot. Well, one of the things we tried to do is to settle this debate over how many gaps by trying to calibrate the one genealogy in the Bible where I think you can do that, and that's Genesis 11. And that's the genealogy that takes you from Noah down to Abraham. Well, we have a good historical date for Abraham. You can get a historical date by looking at the biblical chronology, but today we have the archaeological evidence to independently establish an historical date for Abraham. Abraham's name now shows up in a number of archaeological finds. In either case, you come up with a date that he was on the planet about 4,000 years ago. So he would have been in an active state at that time. But as you read down the genealogy, you notice that halfway down the genealogy, exactly halfway down, you have this gentleman named Peleg. Now, if you go back one chapter, Genesis 10, verse 25, it tells us that the world was divided in the days of Peleg. And there's been quite a bit of discussion over exactly what that text means. But I think today we have the scientific insight to appreciate what that verse is really all about. In the sense that we notice in the beginning of Genesis 11 that God is emphasizing once again the need for humanity to become globally occupying the planet. And in fact, what we notice in the first nine chapters of Genesis is that God is repeating the command he gave in Genesis 1 in the beginning of Genesis 9. Now, he says to Noah, I want you and your descendants to multiply and fill the earth. When we come to Genesis 11, the human species is still resolutely disobeying that command. Let us build a city and a tower so we can remain as one people in one place and not be scattered over the face of the earth. But God supernaturally intervenes and scatters humanity forcibly over the whole face of the earth. But there's one thing blocking forcible migration, and that's the fact that the Bering Land Bridge is cold. While we have new evidence that demonstrates that the Bering Land Bridge warmed up just before it broke, and so there is a narrow window of time, less than 3,000 years wide, where we've got a bridge joining Siberia with Alaska. And the bridge is about 500 miles wide, so it's not a narrow bridge. It's a big, wide bridge. But until 14,000 years ago, it was much too cold for easy human migration. But starting 14,000 years ago, the Ice Age was now well receded, and that whole Bering Land Bridge warmed up. In fact, it was considerably warmer than it is today, average temperature of 56 degrees. And scientists recently, 2 years ago, recovered food grains all across the Bering Land Bridge and were able to carbon 14 date those grains. And they come in at about 12 to 13,000 years ago. And also, we can document all along the coast of British Columbia, where you got all those islands and the mainland, and all down through Alaska and the Bering Land Bridge, you can document the rise of sea level. And what these oceanographers have been able to demonstrate is that sea level all along that coastline rose 500 feet and rose over the course of only a few centuries. And that has now been carbon 14 dated as about 12,000 years ago. 11,000 years ago. So 11,000 years ago, we have an accurate scientific date for when the Bering Land Bridge was broken, and we now have the Bering Strait, and the Bering Strait was impassable literally for more than 10,000 years. In fact, there's the Queen Charlotte Islands off of British Columbia, a rather large set of islands inhabited by the Haida Indians, and those Indians were cut off for 10,500 years because there was this Hecate Strait, which no boat could traverse. And likewise, the Bering Land Bridge was so treacherous that no boat could traverse it. And actually, I think that was part of God's plan. That meant that the human beings that have migrated over the Bering Land Bridge and moved into North America couldn't come back. So it prevented the human species from repeating the mistakes of the pre-flood peoples. And I don't know if any of you here are from Australia, but there was nice land bridges joining the Australian continent with Southern Asia, or at least to such a degree that you could see land across the other side and take a boat over. And likewise, there is a bridge joining France and Britain at that time. And so there was all these pathways were all put into place for humanity to become globally occupied. And to make sure that humanity stayed globally occupied, these bridges were broken. And then we had these treacherous straits that would prevent people from coming back to one place one time. Well, if you have Peleg living 11,000 years ago, and you've got Abraham living 4,000 years ago, and if the lifespans recorded in Genesis 11 are proportional to the passage of time, now I admit that's debatable, but it's also a reasonable assumption to make. If that assumption holds up, you get a date for Noah that comes in around 30 to 35,000 years ago, and you get a date for Adam and Eve that comes in at about 50,000 years ago. But as you see here, I'm trying to be rather generous with the error bars. I think it's more like 50,000 plus or minus 10, but I'm willing to make it as big as 50,000 plus or minus 20, simply because we got that assumption about the passage of time. That may not be correct, but it's all we got to go with. Now, I notice that one of the individuals speaking here is making the point that this is quite inconsistent with the most ancient Australians. And what he is referring to, or will be referring to, is the fact that we have a thermoluminescent date at one site in Australia that places the Aborigines at 60,000 years ago. But thermoluminescence is not the same as carbon-14 dating. It basically only gives you an upper limit. So the 60,000-year date for the most ancient Australians is simply 60,000 years or less. Now, if you're not familiar with thermoluminescence, one of the things I did with my boys when they're really young is I bought these phosphorescent stars and I pasted them on their ceiling and put it up so that they could have the Big Dipper pointing to the North Star. I figured if I put it in their bedroom and they ever get lost, they'll know which direction north is, that they can see the stars. But it also had an interesting application in that I would put them to bed and then they would turn the light on and read. And so in order to make sure that their bedtime was obeyed, these stars served a second purpose because they'd hear me coming down the stairs and they quickly turn the light off, but the stars would be glowing. So I knew exactly what they were doing. In fact, I could look at how bright those stars were and figure out how much time had been traversed since they turned the light off. Well, that's basically thermoluminescence dating. However, it's why this only gives you an upper limit is that you're assuming full illumination. You know, what if you have a lower wattage light? Then you're not going to get the same date as you would if it was fully illuminated. So whenever you read in the literature that they have a thermoluminescence date for some kind of bipedal primate species, and by the way, the vast majority of the dates that are out there are thermoluminescence dates. So when you read the scientific literature and it talks about we have a date of 3 million years for this Australopithecine, read it carefully. If it's a thermoluminescence date, that's an upper limit. It's 3 million years or less. And this is part of the chaos that is a problem in looking at bipedal primate evolution.
And the carbon-14 method is more precise and informative.
Pardon me?
The carbon-14 method.
Yes, it is, but rarely do we have carbon-14. And carbon-14 is only reliable back to about 40,000 years. The half-life of carbon-14 is 5,715 years. And typically with radiometric dating, if you're a factor of 6 removed from the half-life, the method is useless. So carbon-14 is going to be of no value for dating Neanderthals. But it is of value for dating, say, the Aborigines. And in this disputed case where they had this date of 60,000 years, about a year and a half ago, they found some carbon remains at the site. And they were able to date that through carbon-14. The date came in at 3,000 years ago. So this is an example where the thermoluminescent date was off by a factor of 20 times. And with the Aborigines dating 3,000 years ago, we have no problem with our calibrated date out of Genesis chapter 11. Now, I do believe there are legitimate dates for the Aborigines that come in at 30,000 years ago. But 30,000 would be consistent with a rapid migration after the flood. And that's something we see in Genesis 11, is that there was this forced, rapid migration after the flood. In fact, my colleague, Fuzz Rana, has just posted a discovery on our reasons.org website, a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that documents that the coastlines of southern Asia and the coastlines of western North and South America facilitated an extremely rapid migration. Now, I grew up in coastal British Columbia, and this paper is right on the target in the sense that on the coast of British Columbia, it's real easy to live. You've got abundant shellfish. You can just pull right off the beach. It's easy to fish. There are berries all along the shore. It's easy to walk along the shore. It would be no trouble at all to migrate several hundred miles per month. And indeed, the archaeological evidence shows us that humans reached the southern tip of South America in less than 1,000 years after they crossed the Bering Land Bridge. And likewise, along the south shore of Asia, there would be that same facility. The shorelines are the places where life is easiest to live and it's easiest to make rapid movement. It's hard to go through a thick forest. It's not that hard to walk along a beach. So all this is really quite consistent once we recognize that these thermoluminescence dates are upper limits. Now, in terms of other archaeological finds, we have what are called the Big Bangs of anthropology. It's not just astronomers that have the Big Bang theory. Anthropologists have their own Big Bang theory. And one of the more remarkable Big Bangs is what they call the Jewelry Big Bang. You know, what's different about human beings compared to all the other bipedal primates? We're the only ones that wear jewelry. With the Neanderthals, we have zero evidence for jewelry. Homo sapiens idaltu, zero evidence for jewelry. This forest man that they recently found in Indonesia, no jewelry. Homo erectus, no jewelry. But when human beings show up on the scene, jewelry immediately appears. And incidentally, the jewelry is about 10 times as abundant as the tools are. We do see Neanderthals using primitive tools. When humans come on the scene, there's a lot more tools, and the tools are much more sophisticated. But interestingly, the jewelry always outweighs the tools. And I think that's true in households today, that your typical household has more jewelry in it than it has tools. But it's a sudden eruption. It's not an evolution. And as you look at primitive humans from, say, 40,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, the jewelry use is relatively constant. And the degree of sophistication is also relatively constant. In terms of language, we see this sudden eruption of language with the human species. And they say, how can you tell whether there's language going on? Well, there's certain cultural things that you would recognize could only be there if the people were communicating at a high level of linguistic complexity and a large level of vocabulary. And this suddenly shows up on the scene 40,000 years ago. And, to the effect that we're the only species that has vocabulary sizes that number in the tens of thousands of words, and we're the only species that spends 25,000 words plus per individual per day. Now, you do have certain gorilla individuals that have been trained to get a vocabulary of 300 words. Likewise, there are parrots that have vocabularies of a similar size, but they lack grammatical complexity. You don't see the verb subject-object form like you do in our language. Moreover, those individual animals only gain that vocabulary size by spending 20 years plus with an individual that's literally working with that creature every single day to build up that vocabulary. And if something happens to the human being, the vocabulary quickly disappears. So it's simply a mark of how these creatures have been designed by God to enjoy a relationship with human beings. My wife says that I have a cat that's actually developing quite a high vocabulary. As far as I can tell, that cat has only developed one grammatical form, namely the command tense. So, clothing, Big Bang, human beings are the only species that wears clothes. I'm not talking about these dogs. They're forced to wear clothes. But humans are the only ones that willingly wear clothes. Neanderthals, zero evidence of clothing use. Likewise with the bipedal primates. And the thing we notice with humans, they don't wear a small amount of clothes. There's lots of clothes. Even in the most ancient human finds, you realize they've got more than one change of clothing. So it's not just kind of the loincloth image you see in the comic strips. These were creatures that actually invested heavily in developing a lot of clothing. And then the toolkit. What we notice is that lots of species use tools. Chimpanzees use tools. Porpoises and dolphins use tools. Certain birds use tools. And likewise, Neanderthals use tools. Now, the Neanderthals' tool use was a little more sophisticated than what we see with chimpanzees today. But it was basically exploitation of what was already there. The most sophisticated we see in non-human species is where a creature would pick up a rock, a hammer rock, and smash it against another rock, and it would splinter, and it would basically use the pieces that came from that. That's the most sophisticated you see. When human beings come upon the scene, they begin to manufacture tools that they can use to manufacture tools. And they begin to put things together, like they have a wooden handle they'll put together with an axe head and actually connect it together. And you notice that the sophistication of tools grows as the society matures. This is unique to humanity. And so there's this advanced toolkit, but again, it suddenly shows up on the scene 40,000 years ago. Advanced art shows up on the scene 33,000 years ago. And once again, you got to be careful with this. Some non-Christian anthropologists will point to other creatures that engage in art. But it's a kind of art that would only be put on display in a modern museum of art. You can get an elephant to swing a bucket of paint and put something on a canvas. Likewise, you can get chimpanzees doing that. But we notice in the certain caves in France, dating 33,000 years ago, as you'll see murals of these animals being portrayed. And given the level of brush technology they had and pigment technology, the art they display is every bit as advanced as the art we are able to do today. In fact, as you look at the French and Spain cave art, and it spans from about 11,000 years ago to 33,000 years ago, we see zero evolution in the quality of the art. And when you compare it with modern art, again, taking into account that we have more technology today, again, we see no change. So there's another example that at the intellectual level, we're demonstrating zero evolutionary advance. Now, you might complain about the recency of these dates. How come these dates are coming in 40,000 years ago when we have the calibration of the Bible, Genesis 11, coming in 50,000 years ago? Well, this is explained by the fact that archaeological finds are only going to show up when you have a relatively large population. If the population is small, there will not be enough stuff produced to leave behind a long-lasting archaeological record. And so what we're documenting here is not the origin of humanity, but the origin of a large population of humanity. And therefore, 10,000-year separation is entirely within reason. But the biggest advance in human anthropology has been in using the mitochondrial DNA to try to develop a date and a location for the first man and the first woman. Now, the technique goes as follows. You sample people all over the world in different ethnic groups, and you measure the diversity in the mitochondrial DNA. And then you dig up people that have been dead for a measured period of time. And Japan's been a great place to do this because they have all these graves and you can determine through carbon-14 how long that creature's been there. And they kept good care of the bodies so that you can get a faithful recovery of the DNA. And what that does for you is allows you to measure the rate of evolution in human mitochondrial DNA. Now, this technique allows you to determine whether the human species is descended from one or a few women or many women, and whether we're descended from a woman that comes from one region or many women from many different regions. And 3 and 4 years ago, there is a debate, and it's a debate that we portray in this book. It's the multi-regional hypothesis for the origin of humanity compared with the uni-regional hypothesis for the origin of humanity. Well, I'll just cut to the bottom line conclusion. Discoveries in the past 18 months have established that the multi-regional hypothesis is wrong. And once anthropologists figured out that Neanderthals can't be our ancestor, they looked at Homo erectus. And the thing about Homo erectus is that you can find Homo erecti finds in Africa, Europe, and Asia. So there was this idea that all the different races of humanity came from different subsets of the Homo erectus population. But mitochondrial DNA analysis on the human population proves that that hypothesis must be wrong, that the human species came from one region only. And also bears out the fact that humanity started off in one locale and then rapidly spread over the whole planet Earth. Now, you can also get a date for when this first woman lived. And the date comes in at 150,000 years ago. And it's got a rather large error bar, plus or minus 100,000 years. And that error bar has to do with the fact that it appears that mitochondrial DNA does not exclusively come from the mother. There's probably a tiny contribution coming from the father. And this is referred to as heteroplasmy. And in particular, they were able to dig up the Tsars of Russia. And they looked at about 4 generations of the Tsars, the most recent, and they could see heteroplasmy all the way through that line of the Tsars. And there's now some discussion to the fact that this is ubiquitous to the human population. And the bottom line there is that heteroplasmy would mean that you would divide the published date for mitochondrial DNA Eve by 3. And it gives you a date of 50,000 years ago. So we come from one place, one woman, or just a few women, dated around 50,000 years ago. And I think what's of some comfort to the Christian community, the scientific literature refers to this first woman as mitochondrial DNA Eve. They actually give it a biblical name. Well, we can do the same thing with a Y chromosome.
Sorry, I just asked how are these 150,000 years related to 50,000 years?
Okay. If you have no heteroplasmy, you get 150,000 years ago. If heteroplasmy is a significant factor, you divide the number by 3. And at least in that one case where we can actually determine or test whether or not there's heteroplasmy, namely the line of the Tsars, we were able to see it in every single individual. So there's a growing consensus that we have to divide the number by 3. But, I mean, if you read newspaper articles, they talk about mitochondrial DNA Eve living 150,000 years ago. So when you see those articles, just divide the number by 3.
Right. And you're saying this evidence would be alone would be compatible with either 150,000 years or 50,000 years, but there is the additional evidence that you have to divide it by 3. So
right.
you're back to the original.
You're back to the original 50,000-year date. And what makes that especially compelling is that we can do analysis on the male side with the Y chromosomes. And again, this works similar to mitochondrial DNA. Y chromosomes are only shared by the males. Women don't have Y chromosome. So the only way my Y chromosome DNA can be different from my dad's is if I experience a natural mutation. But now we're working with nuclear DNA, not mitochondrial DNA. Heteroplasmy is not a factor in Y chromosome DNA. And because we're dealing with nuclear DNA, these kinds of genetic measurements have much greater precision. You know, notice with the Y chromosome, or one of the mitochondrial DNA, we're looking at a rather large error bar. But when you talk about Y chromosomes, we're looking at a small error bar. So the date that we're getting for the first man comes in at 42 to 54,000 years ago. Now, this is a date that I think legitimately you can compare with our best calibration of the Genesis genealogies. That's a fair comparison. And incidentally, non-Christian geneticists have made note of that approximate coincidence of dates, and they refer to this first man as the Y chromosome Adam. And also you get the same answer, the first man came from one location. And so this is referred to in the scientific literature as the Garden of Eden hypothesis. And incidentally, the Garden of Eden they've been able to locate. And what you'll see in the scientific literature is they've located the Garden of Eden as being Eastern Africa. But we argue in Who is Adam that that's entirely consistent with Northwest Mesopotamia, which I think is the best site from a biblical perspective for the origin of humanity. And the reason why they're saying Eastern Africa, this is where we see the greatest mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome diversity in the human species. Africans have more diverse DNA than the rest of the peoples on the planet. And you know that's interesting in terms of this debate about the races, because you know all these people are black, and yet their DNA is much more diverse than, say, the DNA of Indians, Chinese, and whites. But I think there's another reason why we see such great diversity amongst the Africans compared to the rest of the peoples of the world, and that they practice diversity in this sense. Most of you are probably familiar with that missionary annals of Stanley going into Central Africa. And what he discovered when he went into Central Africa were these black tribes living side by side, where one tribe would be exclusively pygmies, and yet just 2 or 3 miles away would be a tribe that was exclusively giants. And what we're talking is about one tribe being 3.5 feet tall on the average, with very little diversity in height, next to a tribe that was 7 feet tall on the average, again with very little diversity of height. And my point here is a point we make in this book, is that we need to take into account cultural factors. This conclusion that the human species originated from Eastern Africa makes the assumption that we migrate randomly, just like the other animals, and that we maintain cultural diversity randomly. Well, I would argue that because of our advanced spiritual nature, we don't behave like the other animals. We do not migrate randomly, and we don't set up random cultures. And for example, what we see with the Africans is they practice their separate ethnicity, whereas the rest of the world, it was quite common to have intermarriage between different population groups. The Africans have kept that. In fact, there's considerable worry now amongst geneticists that the fact that the Africans no longer practice this ethnic separateness means that this DNA evidence is rapidly going to disappear. In fact, the next 20 years is our window of opportunity. 20 years from now, this kind of research will no longer be possible. The human species will be too mixed up ethnically. I mean, I live in the Los Angeles area, and that's where you see tremendous ethnic mixing. Racial diversity means nothing in who you choose for a marital partner. But it still is a factor in Africa. But it's much less of a factor today than it was even 30 years ago. And this is going to impact our capacity to do this kind of study.
Can you just tell us what happens when you do these analyses, but you pass through that bottleneck of the time of Noah?
I'm going to get to that. That's part of our model. It's what referred to. Oh boy, I've lost my cursor again. There it is. Okay. It's called the Younger Adam Paradox. Let me just finish the story in the Garden of Eden. Okay, if you take into account that we humans do not migrate randomly, that leaves the door open that there might have been a non-random migration early from the Middle East into Africa, and once in Africa, there is a practice ethnic separateness that would completely explain the mitochondrial DNA location of human origins in Africa and the Y chromosome location in Africa. And so taking that into account, we would realize that this out of Africa hypothesis is completely consistent with the Garden of Eden being in Mesopotamia. Although my co-author, Fuzzle Rana, he's the biochemist who co-authored this book with me, also makes the point that you could actually interpret the Garden of Eden passages in the Bible to be compatible with Eastern Africa if you wanted to. But I would argue that there is no need to do that. Simply recognizing that humans are non-random migrators is adequate, and especially when you see in the text that you've got God forcibly imparting on human beings a migration pattern that they did not intend. But in terms of the younger Adam paradox, what geneticists have done is to try to look at very stable populations and compare the mitochondrial DNA date with the Y chromosome date. And in this case, they assume heteroplasmy, which means they're dividing the mitochondrial DNA dates by three. And the whole point is they're trying to ensure that the mitochondrial DNA date was consistent with the Y chromosome date, on the assumption that the first man lived at the same time as the first woman, which seems like a very reasonable assumption to make. That's a demanded assumption, as a matter of fact. But when, in fact, they did these studies, and what I mean by stable populations are populations where there's very little migration in or immigration out. And some good examples would be the Finns, the Estonians, the Japanese, the Armenians, and the Jews. Those are population groups that have not tolerated much mixing with other people groups. And every time you do that, what you observe is that the mitochondrial DNA date, even with heteroplasmy, is several thousand years previous to the oldest possible date for the Y chromosome. And this is called in the scientific literature the younger Adam paradox, that Adam appears to be, or Eve appears to be on the scene 3,000 to 5,000 years before Adam shows up on the scene. And this is viewed as something that's impossible for good reasons. Yes, need to change the tape? Okay, I'm going to let you change the tape, and then we'll pick this up. I'll take a question. I'll repeat it, sure. Yeah, it is the same region. Yeah, it's the identical region. I'm simply making the point that if you acknowledge non-random migration, then it doesn't necessarily have to be that region, but it does have to be a single region, and it does have to be a region that's relatively close to that. So it could be Egypt, it could be the Middle East, it could be Persia, but it's not going to be China or Australia. Okay, the younger Adam paradox. How, when you look at these stable populations, Estonians, Finns, Japanese, Armenians, or Jews, we notice that you consistently have the first woman living thousands of years before the first man. Now, you had a great insight there, that this is exactly what you'd expect from a biblical perspective, because what the Bible actually teaches in the flood account is that the human species is descended from eight people on board Noah's Ark. But notice the difference between the men on board the Ark and the women on board the Ark. The men are blood related to one man, Noah. And therefore, from a biblical perspective, we would expect a Y chromosome bottleneck, not at Adam, but at Noah. In other words, from a biblical perspective, what these geneticists are measuring is the time back to Noah, not the time back to Adam. They should, in fact, refer to this as the Y chromosome Noah, not the Y chromosome Adam. On the other hand, the four women on board the ark are not blood related to one another. They are the wives of Noah and his three sons. Therefore, in that case, we could have the mitochondrial DNA first woman easily go back thousands of years, perhaps even all the way back to Eve herself. But only from a biblical perspective would we predict that you would have a date of thousands of years younger for the first man than you would for the first woman. So this is a wonderful genetic tool we have, not only for putting to the test the theology of Genesis 1 through 3, but also the theology of Genesis 6 through 9. In fact, of all the scientific tests I can think of for testing the flood account of Genesis, this is by far the best. Now, you know, there are other creationists out there saying that they've got good tests for the Genesis flood. But in my opinion, these tests are not credible. And I document this in this book, The Genesis Question. But the genetic evidence, I think, is very credible and is one of the ways, really the only way we have, to test the date for the Genesis flood and also to test the historicity of the Genesis flood. Hey, I'm going to allow the rest of the time for questions and discussion, but one of the things I want to remind you is that we maintain a daily telephone hotline at our office. If you're like me, I always think of my best questions 2 or 3 weeks later, and please take advantage. You can call us and talk to us, or if you've got some atheist down the street that's giving you a hard time, we'd rather talk to the atheist. We've led quite a few to Christ over our hotline. And also, if you're interested in the subject of the latest scientific evidences for the God of the Bible, every week we do a worldwide live webcast. That's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific time. And we talk about the scientific discoveries of the past week, but we invite people to call in. We take emails. And hey, if that's not a convenient time for you, we archive every single webcast. And we give you detailed notes so that you can pick up just that 10-minute segment you're interested in. And we also give you hot links to the research papers so you can see for yourself what these research papers are saying. And finally, you'll see at the book table we're making available. Oh, by the way, you may be interested in this. We have fully accredited graduate-level courses on apologetics that we're offering through the web. They're fully interactive, both with the professor and the other students. And the enjoyable thing from my perspective is that you get to talk with students all over the world at the same time. And so if you want to participate in that, that's available. And actually, I have a donor that's making available 4 scholarships for people at this conference. So if that's of interest to you, come see me, and I'll give you a scholarship application. And finally, we make available a free magazine, and it's on the table, which keeps you up to date on some of these latest scientific discoveries. So any comments or questions? Or I should say additional comments and questions. Yes?
Okay, so this first man and first woman, you say you had a very little genetic relationship to the Neanderthal.
Right.
So where did they come from?
Well, what this evidence is showing us, okay, I have to repeat the question. The question is, okay, the first man and first woman have DNA that's very different from the Neanderthals. What is that telling us about where they came from? Well, it's telling us that they did not come from a previously existing species. They must have been specially created. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, it uses 2 verbs for the appearance of Adam and Eve. Asa, bara. Asa means to manufacture. Bara means to create brand new. And in this book, I describe how we're worshiping a God that works with 3 different kinds of miracles. Sustaining miracles, like you see in Colossians 1, where Christ is holding together the whole cosmos by his creative power. And that's manifested in these incredible design features we see in the universe. But then he performs intervention miracles, where he doesn't violate the laws of physics, but he intervenes in the record of nature in a supernatural way. And I believe that's what the verb Asa is all about, that God came down to the earth, took the dust of the earth, and supernaturally constructed the bodies of Adam and Eve. But what's brand new about Adam and Eve is their spirit, and that's bara. God created that brand new, not from that which existed. He really brought it into existence by his own word. So that's why we see 2 verbs for the creation of humanity rather than just 1 verb. And in terms of the scientific evidence, it's now overwhelming that the human species is not a natural product. This is a supernatural act. And I would argue that the lack of evolution that we see in Neanderthal also forces that conclusion. In fact, we can now definitively demonstrate, as we point out in this book, that Homo erectus, Neanderthal, Homo sapiens idealtu, and the archaic Homo sapiens we see in Israel, all those species must be specially created. We don't have the data to go back any earlier, but we know those species at least are special creations because we cannot trace an ancestor for them. Anything previous to them has the same problem, that it shows no evolutionary advance over time. So yeah, this is a really remarkable find. 2 years ago, I couldn't make that statement. Today, I can. Yes?
Well, granted that you are on the sort of cutting edge of where this discipline's headed, what do you think is the central state of the discipline today? I mean, you could still, as of last year, I'm in the Smithsonian Institute, and we've got, you know, the monkey demand thing, four times life size right across the top of it. Where do you feel the center of the discipline is? And are they catching up? Are they resisting? What's going on?
Well, the question is, where is the discipline moving today? Secular anthropology and human genetics. They're highly disturbed at these biblical implications. That is quite clear. I mean, unlike the disciplines of astronomy and physics, where you got large numbers of evangelicals doing work, the thing I've observed is that anthropology is a discipline that seems to be really devoid of Christians. There are a handful of evangelicals who are doing research, but the vast majority are not even theists, let alone Christians. And this is very disturbing to them. And they're using Christian terminology simply because the evidence is compelling them in that direction. But no, we're not claiming that this is bringing them all to faith in Christ, but it is bringing them to a point of serious consternation. And you'll see in their literature, and this is particularly brought out in such journals as Human Genetics, Nature, Science, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they're really disturbed at the chaos that their discipline has been thrown into. But their discipline is only chaotic from an evolutionary perspective. From a Christian perspective, this isn't chaos, this is resolution. But they see it as chaos. Why? Because their model is being overthrown. And they're acknowledging that their model is in serious trouble. But they're thinking they can come up with another model to replace it. But right now they have no other model. And one of the reasons why we're bringing this book out, we use the same approach in this book that we've done in this book we have already out, The Origins of Life. Namely, chapter by chapter, we compare the evolutionary model side by side with our biblical model and ask two questions. Which model explains the data better? And which model exhibits greater predictive success? As you go through it chapter by chapter, I think it becomes quite compelling. And we're hoping that this will have a significant impact on the scientific community. And indeed, we've already gotten some excellent reviews from anthropologists. But when it gets out in print, I'm hoping it will do the same thing this book did. A Nobel laureate read this book and said, this is the book that puts to death the evolutionary paradigm. We're hoping to get a similar response from this book. And we got 8 more books coming that are going to roll out our testable creation model. And by the way, for what it's worth, we defend our model in front of atheist professors on major university campuses. And we invite an audience to come and just see how that goes. So we'll give our model, and we invite the leading atheist science faculty on that campus to give a response. So we give them 10 minutes each to give a response. But they never question our scientific conclusions. What we've noticed every time we do that is they switch to philosophy. Yes?
I have a question. Do you believe that animals were dying before Adam sinned? And how can it be reconciled with the fact that God created everything good?
Okay, good question. Where do we stand on animal death before Adam's sin? And how do we reconcile that with a biblical statement that the original creation was good? Well, there are two places in the Bible that explicitly address what kind of death Adam introduced when he sinned. Romans 5:12 and following, and then you've got 1 Corinthians 15:20-22. And in both of those passages, Paul very carefully excludes plants and animals. He says in Romans 5:12 that when Adam sinned, death through sin was visited upon all human beings. The text says men, but it's a generic term. And therefore, we see Paul giving two qualifiers. He says this is death through sin, not death universal, but death through sin. Well, the point there is only one species is capable of dying through sin. Birds and mammals don't sin. We're the only ones that are incapable of sinning. He says death through sin was visited upon all men. So I think the fact that Paul is being so careful to qualify his terms and actually gives two qualifications tells us that he was implying that the door was open for plant and animal death before Adam sinned. And likewise, we see Paul making the same careful qualifications in 1 Corinthians 15:20-22. I document all that in this book, A Matter of Days, where we kind of talk about, are the creation days 24-hour periods or are they long periods of time? Both are literal readings of the text, but only one of those models is consistent with all 20 creation accounts. Now, in terms of the good creation, as you go through all the creation accounts of the Bible, we realize that another creation is coming that will replace this creation, the new creation of Revelation 21 and 22. And what it tells us in Romans 8 of this creation is that the law of decay pervades the entirety of the creation, the second law of thermodynamics. And we notice in Genesis 1, that second law was in effect before Adam sinned, and it was in effect after he sinned. How do you draw that conclusion? It tells us in the text that stars were burning before God created Adam and Eve. Stars are extremely sensitive to even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics. Likewise, it tells us that we have creatures eating before Adam sinned. That's metabolism. Metabolism is another process that's extremely sensitive to even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics. In fact, this morning, that's where I drew some of my evidence for the supernatural design of the cosmic features of the universe and the laws of physics. Metabolism and stellar burning are great places to dig that out. Now, what we also notice in Romans 8 is that this law of decay remains in effect until the fullness of the adoption of the children of God. And in Revelation 20, we have the great white throne judgment, where God finally and permanently conquers evil and removes evil from his creation. And then we're taken into this new creation, and we're told about the new creation. There is no death there, there is no crying, there is no tears, there is no decay. We also discover there's no gravity and there's no electromagnetism. So the second law is no longer in effect. Now, what that tells me is that the primary purpose for God creating this universe was to provide a theater for the efficient, rapid conquest of the problem of evil. And once evil is conquered, this universe will have fulfilled its purpose and God replaces it with a brand new universe. Now, how does that answer the question about the goodness of the first creation? It's the perfect creation for the conquest of evil, but it's not the best creation. That's why I think the term you use there is good rather than best. The best creation is yet to come. In fact, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 2:9, the new creation is so good, so wonderful, so perfect, no one can think or imagine how great and wonderful it will be. It's a new creation where sin no longer exists. Because sin no longer exists, we don't need gravity, and we don't need to be enslaved by space and time. To me, the most exciting part of the new creation is we'll finally be delivered from the slavery of living within a universe of length, width, height, and time. In the new creation, God's going to give us the capacity for simultaneous intimate relationships. That's impossible in this universe, and I'd argue it would be dangerous in this universe given the presence of evil. The fact that we're confined to a single dimension of time limits how much damage we can do to one another with our sin. For the new creation, sin will be gone, and therefore God can allow us to intimately relate simultaneously with millions of other believers. And so in that context, we realize that physical death of plants and animals is all part of God's plan to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. Now, if you want to hear more about it, we have a 6 audio tape series where we go into that whole question. A good chunk of that's in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, although that book is not here at the conference. But you can get it for us by going to reasons.org. And one thing you notice in Genesis 1, too, is that God made 2 different kinds of long-legged land mammals for the human species. I believe the correct way to interpret the 6th creation day is God is making 3 kinds of specialized land mammals to cohabit the planet with us and to serve us. And it says of the long-legged ones, there are 2 types, the easy to tame and the difficult to tame. The easy to tame, in my opinion, are the herbivores. And it's not my opinion. You can go to Job 39, which talks about those 6-day land mammals that God creates. And, you know, some of them are carnivores, some of them are herbivores. But one of the things we note is the herbivores are easy to tame. In fact, the way I interpret Genesis 39, you get a list of birds and mammals from the ones that are easiest to tame to those that are the most difficult to tame. The herbivores make excellent farm animals, but terrible household pets. Okay? The carnivores make terrible farm animals, but they make excellent household pets. And I think it was God's intent, even before sin existed, that we would have the full panoply of these birds and mammals, because we get a level of enjoyment from the carnivores that we don't get from the herbivores, and vice versa, from the herbivores that we don't get from the carnivores. So in that sense, I would caution all Christians, don't call that evil what God calls good. As I read my Bible, the death of plants and animals is something that is good. It's not something that's evil. It's the death of humans that is evil. Yes?
A much more general question. Very interesting indeed. I can imagine dialogues, and I've read some that you have with young earth creationists. I don't want to ask about that. But what about with Orthodox Jews and their dating of the dating of Adam to in the year 5700 or something like that?
Well, repeat the question, yes. He's asking me to respond to what do we do about Orthodox Jews and the position they take on the date for humanity. Well, it's a converted Orthodox Jew that runs our Reasons to Believe organization in Africa, David Block. And what he has told me, that Orthodox Jews are a lot like Orthodox Christians. They're splintered. They have a whole different variety of creation theologies. So in Orthodox Judaism, you've got young earth creationists. You also have old earth creationists in Orthodox Judaism. You have framework hypothesis people in the Orthodox Jewish camp. So the discussion we're going to hear tomorrow, young earth, old earth, framework hypothesis, those same debates go on amongst Orthodox Jews.
Do they interact with you, or do they just keep to themselves?
No, they do interact with us. The question is, do these Orthodox Jews interact with us? Yes, they do. In fact, they make up a significant fraction of our mailing list. A lot of Orthodox Jews even give us money just because they like the fact that we're doing research. They don't like the Jesus Christ part, but they like the rest of it. And so they're willing to financially support that.
Right.
Yes?
The exchange of early growth before, you might have said that, I overheard it. And if the first man had not sinned, he would have lived forever. How would that have happened? Would God have had to intervene? Or was it his original natural path not to die, and then God intervened to make him die when he sinned?
Okay, the question,
question.
Right. The question is, if Adam and Eve had not sinned, how would have God allowed them to live forever? Well, there are 2 positions amongst evangelicals in that Adam and Eve may have been inherently eternal before they had sinned, or there are theologians that make note of the fact that there was this tree in the garden, the tree of life, and that Adam and Eve were given permission to eat of that tree. And it tells us in the text that that tree would have reversed the effects of the second law of thermodynamics. So that's the predominant interpretation amongst evangelicals, that Adam and Eve would have been on the way to decay and death, even if they hadn't have sinned, but they would have had access to the tree of life that could have reversed that process. Theologians taking that position use that to conclude that Adam and Eve sinned quickly rather than waiting several hundred years before they sinned. Because if they had waited, say, even 300 years, they would have noticed some decay in their body and they would have run over to the tree of life. But evidently, they hadn't experienced any visible decay before they had sinned. But there is an alternate position that they were inherently capable, free of sin, of living forever.
There's another view that the cross of Christ was in the purpose of God for all eternity.
Yes.
And that human sin enables God to reveal his everlasting love,
right,
which could not be revealed in a sinless world.
Right.
That would be true in any case, though.
It'd be true in either case, right. Okay.
For clarity, the new creation of which you speak in Revelation 21, then does that mean God comes out of his rest on the seventh day?
Yeah, the question is, does God come out of his seventh day rest at the beginning of the new creation? That's the position I hold. There are Christians who hold a different position. Framework people believe that the seventh day is eternal. Young Earth creationists believe it's only 24 hours. We take the position that God remains in a state of creation rest between the creation of Eve and the new creation that follows this creation. So my theological position is that the seventh day is a long period of time in which we're still in, but when evil is conquered, it will come to an end, and then we have the eighth day. In fact, there have been some of us at reasons to believe that have speculated that perhaps God has got this infinite creation calendar laid out for the future, where we've been through the first creation week. Revelation 21 and 22 tell us about the second creation week, but who's to say there's not a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, etc.? You know, God being such a creative creature, who knows what's on his creation calendar? But we have the eighth day to look forward to. By the way, these evaluation sheets you got, you're supposed to fill them out before you leave the room. You're welcome to leave at any time, but not without filling out that sheet. So any more questions or comments? Yes.
Well, kind of a related question, but I've heard some speakers say that the new creation will be a renewal of the present creation rather than explosion, annihilation, and
right,
new creation. I don't know. So I wonder if you have any comments about that.
Okay. Do I have any comments about a common Christian interpretation that the new creation is simply a renewal? And yeah, that's present what I would call Reconstruction theology. And I guess what disturbs me the most about this young earth, old earth debate is I've noticed the young earth creationist camp has been invaded by the Reconstruction theologians, particularly at the Institute for Creation Research and Answers in Genesis. And so those groups are adopting a change in their creation theology, where they now believe that the new creation is simply a restoration of the conditions that Adam and Eve enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. Probably the prime movers in that group would be Doug Phillips and Henry Morris II. They've actually put quite a bit into print, but almost all the leaders of the Young Earth creationist camp were involved in an audio discussion on this issue, which incidentally was a response to our six one-hour tapes. They came up with their own. And what I find remarkable is where our camp differs from their camp is on the eschatology, the theology of the end, not the theology of the beginning. The difference, I think, is much more serious. And I would argue that what you believe about the date for the creation of the earth and the universe has no bearing on gospel theology. It has no bearing on biblical inerrancy. It's not an important theological issue or doctrine. However, I would not agree that the position you take on the theology of the end is inconsequential. I see this as a much more serious issue, and I think it deserves some serious attention from the Christian community. In this sense that, I came to Christ through looking at all the different religions of the world and determining that Christianity was the only one that had objective proof in favor of it. But one of the things I observed is that every religion, predominant religion today, has the same Garden of Eden story that we have in the Bible. That's quite remarkable. They all talk about how the human species started off in paradise, how we lost paradise, and the message of the other religions is that the god or the gods are in the business of restoring us to paradise. But what attracted me about the Bible is it taught a different message, that God's not in the business of restoring us to paradise, he's in the business of delivering us from paradise. And this really gives some insight as to why God would expose us to evil. Our exposure to evil and suffering is a means by which God can prepare and train us to receive something far superior to what Adam and Eve enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. Now, in that context, evil has a purpose. Death has a purpose. And I think this explains why the young earth and the old earth camps differ on their theology of death. It's because they differ so much on their theology of the time of the end. But I'm disturbed about the Christian community drifting into the theology that I see in the non-Christian religions of the world and what I see in the Christian cults like the Jehovah's Witnesses.
To some degree making a parody of what is a common view that whereas in the end times there won't be an identical universe to the one that Adam and Eve were brought into, that there will be some degree of continuity, at least in terms of categories of things like beauty, of dimension, of colour and taste, and so on. I'm not saying that's limited to that, but I was saying it's going to be an existence of an entirely different order, in which case why would we why would the suggestion be that we have resurrection bodies which have some kind of continuity with the bodies that we have?
Good question. Yeah, we have the scriptures that talk about this continuity between this creation and the next creation. Our bodies have a certain continuity. As you mentioned, there's this continuity of beauty and elegance and joy that'll be present in the new creation. And I have no problem with any of that. What I have a problem with is this doctrine that the stars we're seeing today are going to burn for all of eternity, and that's going to be part of the new creation. I can show you a verse in Revelation 21 that explicitly says there will be no stars in the new creation. There will be no sun in the new creation. There will be no electromagnetism in the new creation. The light we experience, which is bright and dark, where there's shadows and darkness, will be replaced with a new creation, a new kind of light where there's no shadows and no darkness at all. This isn't electromagnetism. Likewise, we don't have gravity. It talks about this new Jerusalem structure, 1,200, 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. It's got corners. That violates the law of gravity. There's no gravity in the new creation. On the other hand, I would agree with you. There is geography, there is temporality, there is beauty. There is light. All that's part of the new creation. But it's in a manner that's far beyond the beauty and the light that we experience now. And the relationships we have with one another are far beyond what we can imagine. I mean, the most intimate thing we can imagine in this creation is marriage. But in the new creation, it tells us there is no marriage. There are no families. There is no sex. God replaces all that with something far better, which is why my publisher argued that my book Beyond the Cosmos should have had the title Better Than Sex. We would have sold a lot more copies.
the continuity and discontinuity you're talking about, would it not be better to relate that to the death and resurrection of Christ? The Christ is the key to death. You see both continuity and discontinuity between the resurrected Christ and Christ is also continuous with the history of Israel and yet also different.
Okay, the question. Yeah, I think I got it.
The Holy Spirit born of the Virgin Mary, that's continuity. Mm-hmm. And raised from the dead, but not always recognized, but bodily existence.
Okay, the point he's making is, shouldn't we expect there to be the great discontinuity at the incarnation rather than at the beginning of the second creation? Well, I could take you back to the sermon that Moses gave, his last sermon, where he told the Jews, okay, you have the first covenant, but if you put your faith and hope in the first covenant, you'll have missed the point of why you've been brought into the wilderness by God and now are going to be taken to the promised land. His last sermon was to point the Jews forward to the second covenant that would come in the future. Well, likewise, I would argue that God today is pointing us to the third covenant. We have the incarnation, we have the death and resurrection of Christ, but Christ's work is not yet done. He's going to prepare a place for us. And this is where the laws of physics change. Now, if you want a theological explicit statement on that, Jeremiah 33:25. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. They're fixed from the point of the creation of the universe until the end of this universe. So the end of the universe is where we have the great changes in the laws of physics. And of course, all you got to do is look at the book of Acts and the Gospels, and you can discern from those texts there was no systemic change in the laws of physics. It's physics before the resurrection is the same as the physics after the resurrection.
Not in the resurrection body.
No, not at all. So yeah, there will be a huge discontinuity when we die.
Yeah.
Every Christian that faces a physical death will experience a dramatic discontinuity.
Yeah.
On the other hand, that discontinuity is not brought to its fullness until the end of the age. So for example, when you and I die, and that'll be coming soon enough, we will go to be with the Lord in the kingdom of heaven, but we will go in a state of sleep. Revelation 6:9 speaks about the martyrs asleep under the altar before God. Now, they're aware of what's going on, but they're not allowed to interfere. As we're told in Hebrews, we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Those witnesses are not only the angels, they are those that have died in Christ before us. They're watching us. They have a TV set where they can watch what we're doing, but they can't interfere. But there will come a time in the future when their resurrected body will be brought to them in its fullness, and at that point they'll no longer be asleep. And that, to me, is the great discontinuity. When we're finally brought into the fullness of the resurrection that we share with Christ, whereas all those that have died in Christ are simply in a state of sleep. So I guess those of us that are towards the end, we don't get to rest as long as those that have died before us. We get a short nap before we come into the final fullness. Yes?
Earlier you talked about the theater for the efficient and rapid conquest of evil.
Right.
Which evil is that? Is that the satanic forces? Is that already the fallen universe?
Okay, when I talked earlier about how this universe is the theater for the conquest, the rapid, efficient conquest of evil, what do I exactly mean by that evil? You know, were we talking satanic evil? Were we talking human evil? I'm saying it's all that. It's all the evil that has ever existed. I would argue that Adam is not the first sinner. The first sinner was Satan. And so in terms of when did evil enter the universe, it did not happen when Adam sinned. It happened when Satan sinned. Now, it doesn't tell us in the Bible exactly when he sinned, but he certainly sinned before Adam did. And, what Christ is doing is not only conquering human evil, it's conquering all evil. And as we see that in Revelation 20, it's not just the evil humans that are disposed of in the lake of fire. It's also all the evil angels. So from that point forward, evil will no longer exist. You say, well, why does God put us all through this evil for now? Well, we have to be tested. The analogy I use in Beyond the Cosmos is students going to a university class. And the thing that's always amazed me about my students is they pay my sponsoring institutions a huge sum of money to suffer at my hand. You say, rationally, what makes students do that? Number one, they know the suffering is brief, and they know the suffering will bring about a great reward, hopefully. Well, likewise, that's what this life is all about. God is exposing us to a short season of evil and suffering, and that exposure prepares us for something we otherwise could not receive. And, you know, graciously, it's very brief.
Muslims say test, better preparation, which is a word you use.
Well, I use the word preparation rather than test,
yeah. And
that I think that's consistent with Hebrews 12,
yeah,
where it uses the word discipline, that God now has us alive to discipline us, which to me connotes training rather than this angry God that's, you know. The thing that bothers me about Islam is God is so distant, God is so uncaring, and it's all fatalistic. There's no human responsibility. If what Allah wills will happen. Therefore, if I kill people, it's His fault. It's not my fault.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, although they deny that, though. But I do agree with your God.
Well, it's consistent with their holy book.
Yeah, it is.
So. Okay, one more question, then we all go to dinner.
In your model, it's any model in science, you have quite a large error bar. Do you expect that some future data will help you to decrease those error bars?
Yes, the question had to do about error bars, that with respect to human origins, the error bars are still quite large. And we're on record as predicting that future scientific discoveries will lower those error bars. And as those error bars are lowered, the data will become more consistent with the biblical model rather than less consistent. So this is a wonderful way to put our model to the test. Let's wait another 12 months. We'll have more data. And we would predict that that data will be more consistent with the biblical human origins model than it is today. So, and we are sticking our neck out by making explicit predictions in this book. Okay, dinner time. Thank you.